continue. With the burning ground, and there are some quotations. Yes, I have them on the other computer, unfortunately. But maybe, let's see, Rays and the Initiations Denmark. Yes. Okay. Webinar recordings, audio. Well, maybe I can find some of these definitions of the will, which will be important to us. When I'm switching back and forth with these computers, I oftentimes find that what I need is on the other computer, and then it's not practical to make a transference. All right, so let's see what we have. What he thinks about this. The burning ground has done its work. Test, test, good. It's working, screen is showing, okay. And all is correct, I think. So DK begins by saying there is apt to be misunderstanding here. So to most people, the burning ground stands for one or two things, and he'll tell us what they are here. Either the fire of mind burning up those things in the lower nature of which it becomes increasingly aware, that's one way of thinking of the burning ground, or the burning ground of sorrow, agony, horror, and pain, which is the characteristic quality of life in the three worlds at this time. You know, we live on a planet which is the base of the spine center of the solar logos. And we know how much will is involved when we're dealing with the base of the spine. It's the center which is most activated at the fifth initiation. Now, does anybody know what is the monadic ray of our planetary logos? We know this. It is the first ray. Second ray soul, third ray personality. And we know that when we study the human being and we look to the base of the spine center, it's ruled by what planet? Page 517 in your astrology book. It's ruled by what planet? The base of the spine center in the human being. Yes, Pluto, another first ray planet. It's ruled by Pluto, and of course you can say Uranus with electric fire could be connected with it. Mercury is connected, Mars is connected, and of course the Earth is connected. The Earth is the real base of the spine center. I don't know if it's fully that yet. Sometimes there is a change of focus, you know, like different planets maybe are in triangles and they can represent at any one time a particular chakra in the solar logos. For instance, Venus is definitely connected with the heart center of the solar logos. But is Venus yet fully that heart center, or is it temporarily the solar plexus, and will it one day be the heart center, whereas Jupiter is now? So there is a kind of a shifting, permutations, a changing, where different planetary centers have different functions depending upon the point of development in the solar logos and the point of development through which they may be passing. Earth will certainly, it's a non-sacred planet now, and it's not really in a position yet to be a fully functioning base of the spine center for the solar logos, because its monadic ray is occultly non-effective so far. When it becomes a sacred planet, then the monadic ray, which is the first, which is required for the base of the spine center functioning, will be sufficiently activated for it to play a greater role. So here we live on this very willful planet, in a way, the source of great fire. And you begin to think, well, why should experiences on Earth be so drastic? It has something to do with its function within the whole solar logos. And right now, the planetary logos of the Earth is passing through a fourth initiation of a minor kind in preparation for the second cosmic initiation. All of that is in your Cosmic Fire Book on 384. The sort of sub-initiations of the planetary logos and so forth. So things are tough for us here on this planet because it's not an easy planet. It has to do with the fire of matter very much and the willful rising of the fire of matter. And the forms that are generated on Earth are severely tested so they can withstand the will energy, which will be coming in only stronger and stronger as time goes on. Well, think about the human being passing through the fourth initiation. Is the will energy involved? You know, it may be the fourth ray, pretty much, that governs the fourth initiation, but the will energy is tremendously involved in this liberation from the causal body. You know, it makes me think these different sub-initiations, of which the Earth will have seven and is presently going through four, have a lot to do with the planetary chains. You know, I guess I'm off on a little tangent here, but then what else is new? So here, let's just see here. I'll show you what I mean. Fellowship of Cosmic Fire, yes. There is some animal in this room. The murmur of the bees and insects on their winged flight is heard on every side. This is the law of repulse for the first ray. Then the garden goes down. So here is the picture of the Earth scheme. And I have a feeling that these seven initiations are centered, every one of them, in a different chain of the Earth scheme. And right now, we're down here in the fourth. And this fourth initiation of our planetary logos, which is so drastic, just the way it would be drastic for any human being, is centered right on our chain. And it is, I think, part of a fourth sub-initiation that the solar logos is going through, only he's experiencing it in one of his chakras, which in this particular case is the Earth. So somehow the base of the spine is involved in a very drastic experience that the solar logos is going through as well. So we here on this planet are in the middle of sorrow, agony, horror, and pain that the Second World War, the Great War, gave us, and we don't know whether we're quite finished with it yet. And I would say that right now part of that is part of a planetary triangle that Vulcan and Pluto are making with the Earth. Since those are the two planets that are so important as the lead-up to humanity's first initiation, and they bring in so much of the first ray energy, and there's so much, in a way, connected with the head center and the base of the spine. I think they are very important right now in relation to our planet and in relation to humanity, particularly the fourth kingdom. From another point of view, fourth initiations are ruled by Saturn and Mercury. Can we think of why that might be? These are two very mental planets in a way. One very karmic, one very mental, but both of them actually quite mental. Can we think of why the fourth initiation in general should be ruled by Saturn and Mercury? What do those two planets together give us when they are operating? To lift the material sphere. Well, certainly Saturn is connected with the material sphere, and Mercury with the connection between the higher and the lower. I believe the material sphere is involved, and here's how I think it is. this is my take on it, that one must learn at the fourth initiation to discriminate between life and form. At the fourth initiation, we are liberated from the dense physical body of the planetary logos, even of the solar logos, in fact. This is the dense physical body. All of these lower 21 subplanes. And at that initiation, we are liberated from that part of the solar logos or planetary logos which is ruled by Saturn. In other words, everything below in the 21 lower subplanes is ruled by this lord of materiality, which is Saturn. Now, Mercury, interestingly enough, stands for the Buddhic plane here, onto which the liberation occurs. So together they are very discriminating combination, and they help the fourth degree initiate discriminate between the dense physical body of the logos and his cosmic ethers. And from the time the fourth degree is over, we have made that viveka, or that discrimination, between the dead worlds of the lower 21 subplanes and the living worlds of the cosmic ethers, and so are liberated from material into ether. That's how I think, you know, that's one interpretation of how this works. So we are living on a tough planet at a tough time in its history. And we have a very definite role to play in the future of our solar system. Because, and here's the reason, could you take the fourth or fifth initiation without your base of the spine center? See, obviously not, right? The base of the spine center, from the time the third degree is taken, including the fourth, and finally maximally powerful at the fifth, is needed at all those initiations. Let's make the analogy. What about our solar logos? Our solar logos is a cosmic initiate of the second degree. So he has done something to his astral body, which is permanent. But he's not yet a cosmic initiate of the third degree, our whole system. And that's what he's working on. And by the time he leaves or finishes with this solar system, do you know what his destiny is? It's in cosmic fire, which of course we studied for 5 years, and so we know it by memory. The destiny of our solar logos is to take either his fourth or fifth cosmic initiation in this solar system. Now this, it might be the fourth, it might be the fifth, if he does very well. This places a tremendous pressure on the Earth. And can you think of why that would be so, on the logos of the Earth? Well, when you say universe, you mean solar system, right? Okay. I just want to make... Okay. Well, you know, I'm kind of conservative in my thoughts, so I never go so far. But I would say a source of light for the local cosmos system. This would be as far as I'd be willing to take it, because... Yeah. So, you know, so if you include Sirius and certain of these constellations, yes, I would say it could be relatively a source of light for such a sphere. Earth is meant to be that. But it is the base of the spine center of the solar logos, meaning that it has to function as a full base of the spine center by the time the solar logos takes his fourth or fifth, especially his fifth, cosmic initiation. And what this means is that the Earth itself, the planetary logos of the Earth itself, which is only now moving towards its second cosmic initiation, has to progress very fast if it's going to be able to serve the solar logos in the plans of the solar logos to take the fourth or fifth cosmic initiation. And incidentally, of course, it will become, as you say, a very luminous center, not only for our particular solar system, but probably within a larger sphere. When we talk about the whole universe, see, the word universe is interesting. DK doesn't use the word universe the way astronomers use the word. He oftentimes simply means solar system. That's what he means when he says universe. But when an astronomer uses the word universe, he means billions of galaxies, you know, families of galaxies, huge structures that nobody has yet mapped out yet. So that's way beyond, I mean, we don't even know what's going on in our galaxy, and it's only one of billions, you know. So our particular galaxy is also a universe of a type. And we'll have to know a lot more about our place within the galaxy before we can expand into the larger and larger and so forth. Suffice it to say, our Earth has a special destiny, and that is why we people, who are cells within the chakras of our particular planetary logos, are under such intense pressure. He says, it's our task to suffer. he says the planetary logos is quite, you know, objective about this whole thing, but the cells suffer. And obviously we will gain a great deal through this suffering. But if you really want to look at the larger picture of what's going on here, that's why we're under humanity at the moment is going through such stress. Its fourth initiation, the planetary logos's, no, first initiation, it's humanity's, the planetary logos's fourth initiation of a planetary kind, intraplanetary, moving towards its second initiation of a cosmic kind, with the solar logos taking a fourth subsidiary initiation through our planetary scheme, and himself moving towards cosmic mentality, which he has not yet achieved. And all of this is landing right here on our little planet, especially on our particular globe. So this is the hot spot in the solar system at the moment. And if we can look at it in the larger sense, I think we can understand. Now, I want to ask you a question about burning grounds. How does the fire of mind burn up those things in the lower nature of which it becomes increasingly aware? I mean, in other words, how do you use your mind on this type of burning ground to contribute to the burning process? Do you have any ideas about that? You say accept it, but do you think, of course, there are many things to accept, yes. The question is the use of the mind on the burning ground one of, strictly speaking, acceptance? Or are there other things the mind does on the burning ground or to induce a burning ground which are not about acceptance? Say it a little louder. Understanding. I would say inevitably understanding will be involved, but what about creating? Creativity is also involved here. I'm talking about a more first-ray use of the mind. The mind, exactly. The mind as a destroyer of forms that are unnecessary through the use of mental criticism, analysis, and rejection of what is not rational, useful, meaningful. You know, he says the mind can destroy, right? So, you know, he says a mind in white magic, the mind is like a spinning wheel, and if you're too mentally focused, people try to approach you, and they just get spun off. when they try to approach you, you see. He says, instead, we have to use the heart and its magnetism and so forth. So there is a destructive part of the mind which starts to work with what you think, what you have believed. Suppose you have a crisis of faith, and all of a sudden your mind, which is rational, is entering this situation and saying, look, you're stupid to have believed what you believed. It doesn't make sense, and these are the reasons it doesn't make sense, and all of your beliefs are fallible, and it finds all the reasons why you have been in illusion before. That is a frictional burning ground through the destructive power of the mind. You begin to analyze your situation. You see what I'm saying? And it creates a fire until finally the unnecessary things which don't make sense fall away and are destroyed, and you have a new structure that has been created. Yes, Anne? Is the overshadowing soul or angel doing this process? Well, look, the mind is used by whatever source. The one who's really doing this is the disciple. And if the disciple is overshadowed by the soul or angel and is receiving these impulses and streams of light which reveal the fallibility of the structure that we've been living in, the soul or angel can be involved. But the critical mind, the critical mind is definitely creating a fire by friction situation. See, I'm trying to see, do we understand what Master DK is saying here? Because he says that the mind is considered to be a contributor to the burning ground, and it burns up those things in the lower nature of which it becomes increasingly aware. In other words, Virgo. Think about Virgo. Mercury is so involved. Virgo, one of the most critical purificatory signs, and it detects something in the lower nature which is not up to standard, and it says, this doesn't make sense, we have to get rid of this, we have to purify, we have to put something else in. This causes a lot of friction with your habit patterns. Yes, Ella. Okay, well, do you have something higher? And see, what I'm trying to say is that criticism, self-criticism, which is not necessarily a wonderful thing, but sure, they do. But, you know, is there ever a time for you to analyze what's wrong in your vehicles? See, I'm trying to say that there comes a time for the psychologically oriented person when they do have to take a look at what's working in them and what's not. You know, you might go to a psychologist to do this, or you might just do it on your own, and you take, you know, in the AA program, Alcoholics Anonymous, they say you take a fearless moral inventory, and you analyze everything in your nature. Yes, of course, and that can happen too. And there might be, you might not see something, and the soul will help you. I'm talking in general. So I'm looking here for an analysis of what DK means by the fire of mind burning up those things in the lower nature of which it becomes increasingly aware. You know, remember from esoteric psychology, we have something called the Acclery process. Do you remember that? Alignment, crisis, light, revelation, integration. So in the process of light, the light of the soul comes in and reveals to the disciple everything that's wrong in the system. Then the mind is used to correct all that. See, we don't, DK would say, when we're getting rid of glamour, don't use the soul, use the illumined mind. When you're getting rid of illusion, then use the soul. This is interesting. So we, yes? Yes, yes. Well, you see, don't discount the mind as an instrument of the soul. Self-analysis is necessary, and that's what DK does all the time. He says, allow me to analyze this situation for you. And then he expects the disciple to do something about it. So, you know, I'm asking you, have you ever been through a very uncomfortable situation within yourself where you realize that something really isn't right, and you try to get to the bottom of it to find out what's wrong, and then to correct it using whatever means you might use? You might use the wills of the mind, you might use the soul, whatever it is, but you've got to see it first. You've got to analyze the situation. And I think this type of analysis, let's call it in the light of the soul, in the illumined mind, creates a frictional situation of discomfort in the personality, which some people call a burning ground. You know, you get even the heat in the body changes. You see something shocking going on in your own nature, and it feels uncomfortable until you can resolve it. I'm just trying to make sense of what he says about a burning ground. But the way he describes burning ground is not this. I just want to make sure we understand this. That's all I'm saying. Yes. The opposite could be, for me, the burning ground. It's like cut. You don't have time to analyze, it just goes on fire. I think there are, you know, we're going to move now into a higher analysis or a higher description of the kind of burning ground he means. See, first of all, he says for most people, this is what the burning ground means. So I just want to make sure we understand that much. The world is burning. Okay, we understand that. And people are terribly uncomfortable within themselves, and there's no harmony, and there's only friction. And that's a burning ground too. And the mind is involved in that as it critiques its own type of expression and tries to improve it. And it may use the soul to improve it. But now comes his definition of the burning ground. See, here's the thing. It's so easy to read over something DK says. We kind of act as if we understand it, but if we really start to analyze it, the question arises, do we understand it at all? So that's why I try sometimes to go very cautiously to make sure that the understanding is adequate. But the burning ground referred to here is something very different. And then here comes the very fascinating statement. When the blazing light of the sun is correctly focused on or through a glass, magnifying glass, it can cause ignition. Have you ever done this when you were a kid? You know, there's an old dry leaf. There's the sun. There's a magnifying glass, you know. So you focus the rays, and it starts to smoke, and pretty soon it breaks into flame. Maybe we've all done that. It causes ignition. And now the analogy. When the blazing light of the monad is focused directly upon the personality via the antikarana and not specifically through the soul, in other words, it's an unbuffered, unmoderated type of focus, it produces a blazing fire which burns up all the hindrances in a steady sequential process. That is a very important sentence, and I think we're going to reread that sentence.
It requires that the leaf is dried out of astral.
It's a good analogy, requiring that the leaf be, that the personality be in the right condition to be flammable, which means already you have applied the mind, the light of the mind, to clarify the glamorous situation. He tells us, you know, from the forehead via Venus and the fifth ray, comes the light of the mind. Of course, it's supported by soul energy, naturally. It goes out into the wet world of glamour, and it starts to dissipate those glamours, to dry them out, to take away the life of them, to blow them away like fragments of a leaf or something. So first you have to go through a drying process. Now, two of the driest planets in our range of planets are Saturn and Mercury. At least, you know, symbolically, they are dry. Saturn rules the desert, aridity, and Mercury is not wet. It has to do with mobility in the air and with the wind, which dries. These two planets do not only rule the fourth initiation, they rule discipleship itself. So until we have gone through the discipleship process, we're in no position to bring in the blazing light of the monad. You know, if we're all wet, as it were, with glamours, we're not ready to bring in the monad to make combustible our personality situation. So first things first. When the blazing light of the monad is focused directly upon the personality via the antikarana and not specifically through the soul, you know what I mean? You know, bypassing the soul, as it is said. You've seen the diagrams, haven't you? You know what I mean? Here is the bypassing of the soul. This is the main antikaranic line. And it, I don't know about focus. I hope it's just about as good as we can get, I guess. It bypasses this solar angel sponsored structure, and it reaches directly into and above. So that's how it is meant to work. So, you know, the will comes in, and you don't always say, wait, you know, try to be a little more harmonious in the application of it. Try to be a little more gentle. You got to respect the form, blah, blah, blah. No, this thing comes in. And it is said that God is no respecter of persons. Have you ever heard that statement? God is no respecter of persons. So we can interpret it this way. God, the monad, is no respecter of the forms which are dear to the personality and which constitute the personal tradition of the personality. It says, this stuff is in the way. I shall destroy all obstacles. Nothing can stop my progress to my goal. This is the first ray attitude. And it, whether or not you like those forms, they are going to be combusted. So the monadic experience here is not a comfortable one for the personality, but it's very liberating. It produces a blazing fire which burns up all hindrances. And notice this, not just all at once necessarily, but in a steady sequential process. The first ray, although we might not think of it, is a ray of order. Adherence to the rhythm of the planet. It says, O pilgrim on the way of death. Adherence to the rhythm of the planet. Let me look that up. Will produce the liberation of the hidden blessed one. I just want to point out the purpose of order in the first ray. So adherence to the rhythm of the planet will order bring. That's it. Adherence to the rhythm of the planet will release the hidden blessed one and order bring. So he says, order from chaos. This is the first ray monad. Order from chaos, O pilgrim on the way of death. This is the way for you. Love you must learn, dynamic will you have. The right use of destruction for the furtherance of the plan must be the way for you. Adherence to the rhythm of the planet will release the hidden blessed one and order bring. So when it says here, here's the monadic light, it doesn't make any difference what your ray is. It's a first ray center. And it produces in a steady, sequential, orderly, rhythmic process the destruction of all obstacles. And from that point of view, It stands behind the soul. It stands behind the mind in producing this destruction. But I think it's always better, you know, sometimes you watch your world being burned around you and you didn't have anything to do with it as a personality. But when you can also cooperate as a personality with the intended destruction and understand it, there's your word, it's even better. Just like Master Moria says, if you take vitamins consciously, they do you a lot more good. So you can pop a bunch of pills in your mouth and not think about it, but when you're actually consciously taking the medicine and you're focused on what's actually happening as a conscious being, it does you more good. It's the same with the burning ground. If you know what you're passing through, instead of, oh my God, everything's just burning around me, then it is a more meaningful, spiritually productive process. He says, wording it otherwise, let's see what else we've got there. Okay, wording it otherwise, when the will aspect, streams from the monad, remember, the highest part of the monad is will, out of will, wisdom, and activity. When the will aspect streams from the monad and focuses through the personal will, as the mind can grasp and realize it, it destroys, as by fire, all elements of self-will. These are such potent statements. We should actually ponder for a moment. We'll almost visualize, you would say, the monad with its unfettered enlightenment and its electric fire, because visualization promotes the process, descending down symbolically, the antikarana, it's not really up or down, but vibratorily descending over the antikarana and reaching the mental unit, whether of the individual or the group, and spreading out into the personality and carrying its own geometry with it from the monadic plane and destroying all things in a proper order that do not correspond with its own name, its own geometry, its own archetype, its own sound. So if we visualize that happening, and as a personality or a disciple, we say, okay, I go along with this, I will cooperate with this process, then something of importance really begins to happen, and we are participating in it.
So the causal body is destroyed, and can it be equated with the body of the soul?
Okay, this is a good question. The causal body is destroyed. Can it be equated with the body of the soul? Now, first of all, a lot of this burning ground process happens in the personality before the causal body is destroyed, because there's a lot of purification going on before the final fire. Soul is only sentiency or consciousness. So when we say the soul, we have to define our terms very carefully. There is a center of sentiency on the higher mental plane that we oftentimes call the soul, and it has a certain ring pass knot, and we sometimes call it the body of the soul, and that ring pass knot is destroyed eventually, so that the soul is liberated into higher ring pass knots, rings pass knot, defined by the bodies of the spiritual triad. So consciousness is liberated out of this individual ring pass knot on the higher mental plane, where you're thinking a lot about the individual, about myself. It's liberated into spheres of containment, which are much broader, and it's still the soul. The soul can never be destroyed, only the body, which contains consciousness, can be destroyed. And that's, of course, not the final destruction, because there will come a time at the sixth initiation when the containers of consciousness on the triadal levels will also be destroyed, unless, like the Buddha, you decide you will preserve them for the future use of someone, in this case, the Lord Maitreya. Soul is a general principle which operates throughout the cosmos. So the universal logos, and this time when I use the word universe here, I mean the whole thing, the universal logos has soul, has sentiency. But that degree of soul or sentiency or consciousness will also have to be liberated, because the universe itself is a container of consciousness. And so when the universe disappears, the soul body of the universe is destroyed and consciousness returns to the ultimate state. Now, you know, we've been through this endlessly. If what is said in the Ageless Wisdom is true, there's never been a time when we have not been passing through this confinement and liberation, confinement, liberation, forever. See, that's what it means to begin to live in the eternal, to begin to wake up to the fact that we have been alive forever. We have, you know, been being forever, never born, never dying, and through these processes forever. See, and that changes your mind about things when that begins to happen. Yes, Anne. Yes. That the monad is always staying where it is. And the soul is going back to where it came from. Okay, I would like to modify that thought by saying the type of consciousness we call soul returns to a much more liberated state, which we can call where it came from, in a way. But, the monad itself is also a traveler. So, you know, right now it's on the monadic plane of the cosmic physical plane, and if the bulk of human beings are going to go towards Sirius, the monad doesn't stay in its present surroundings. It changes its focus onto the cosmic astral plane, and it travels on the path or the way of higher evolution. So eventually, what we call the monad also must go back to where it came from. And where it came from is the totally expansive state possible in this universe, which exists within the consciousness and being of the universal logos. That's where it came from. But of course, that's a very temporary state. If you believe Blavatsky, that there's a great breath, in and out, in and out, in and out forever, perpetual motion forever, then even when the monad returns to where it came from, where it came from returns to where it came from. And where it came from is the absolute God, the state that we know nothing about, unknown, unafraid, untouched, for A, unchanged. You know, just go to page 285 or so in Dyna 2, and you'll find those six monadic statements from Formula 3, which is called the seed of all philosophies. Page 2, well, you know, allow me to just have a little digression here, because I just love digressions. Matter of fact, someone told me once, I come to your classes for your digressions. Here it is. I'm hearing something funny here in my headphones. My voice, that's what's funny. Either maybe it was just my ear, or it could have been my head. God is the Lord, for A stands firm. Being exists alone, naught else is. Time is. Being descends to manifest. Creation is. Time, then, and form agree. Being and time do not agree. Unity is. The one between comes forth and knows both time and God. But time destroys that middle one, and only being is. Space is. Time and space reverberate and hide the one who stands behind. Pure being is unknown and unafraid, untouched for A, unchanged. God is. Time, space, the middle one, with form and process go. Pure reason then sufficeth. Being cries forth and says, death crumbles all, existence disappears, yet all for A remains, untouched, immutably the same, God is. So when I think about that Infinity book I wrote, I might as well not have written it. It's all here in six sentences. But this is the basis of everything when it comes to where do we come from. We come from is. Everything is. And yet, nothing changes ever. What's the last sentence? Yet all for A remains untouched, immutably the same. So it's our attempt to fathom these ideas, which will give us a whole new relationship with the factor of being instead of relativity. And this is a job for all of us over the lives as we continue to deepen our study of the wisdom. Yes. You see, so it's difficult to understand that. Yes, it seems that as much, well, if I can understand you, you know, you're far away from me and I'm hard of hearing. But as much as the container seems to change, and as process in the container seems different from when it started, let's call the universe the container, all of that possible change already pre-exists forever in the absolute. Any possible variation already exists, and you can't add anything to the absolute nor take anything away. Why change? It's fun, I think. I guess it's you know, the Hindus on this, they you know, it's the big question, but they talk about the dance, the universal dance, Lila, the universal play, the great song, the drama. It's creation. It's the absolute doing what it does, enjoying itself as its not self. See, I dealt with all this in my book, and you know, nobody can answer that question, but I tried, you know, to give some thoughts about what that might mean. You say, well, then what's the whole point? What's the point? Well, I say it's all pointless. There is no point. I mean, reality is pointless, literally, and I mean metaphysically pointless, without any point in it. It's pointless, but it's enjoyable. Well, there's a nice thing in Cosmic Fire about how God got tired of just being. He felt he was too alone, or it felt it was too alone. And he said, well, we need a universe so there can be evil and something other than God. So then God, the absolute deity, becomes the universe to amuse itself, to seek its own company, so it doesn't be alone with itself. You see, it gets to be almost the language of paradox. But let's just say, I don't even think the universal logos can answer this question. Because I have gone off on a tangent. Okay, because between the greatest being in cosmos and the absolute is to me an infinite gulf. That they are infinitely different. The one and the absolute infinity are infinitely different. And even the greatest being that we call the cosmic being is as nothing, next to nothing, when compared with the absoluteness. We're not going to answer this question. We just better have a good time. Well, and when I say a good time, I mean that because time stops existing when the universe stops existing. So if we're going to have time, which is the universe, it might as well be good. And good means according to the plan that the universal logos was imbued with when the ray flashed forth out of the absolute. So this is all philosophy. And like I said, if we read these six sentences, that's the root of everything. Now, getting back to the rays and the initiations, who led me off on that, or did I do it to myself? Was it you? Did you do it? I need, who is responsible here? All right. So I've sometimes wondered, and maybe we can think about it, what is the blazing light of the monad? What happens on some computer somewhere is what I want to talk about. But I'm just going to have to remember it somehow, because if I go looking, it'll take me 15 minutes. What to you is the meaning of unfettered enlightenment? You know, a fetter is like a chain. A fetter, you tie somebody up. Fetter. Unfettered enlightenment. What is the meaning to you of unfettered enlightenment? The light is liberated. The chains which are holding the light in are broken. And the light expands in all directions and has nothing to condense it. Now, this cup is fettered light. Every form that we're looking at here is a condensed form of light. So in order to create a form, you need a fetter, you need chains, you need a force that condenses light. But when we get into Shambhala, I won't say that in a universal context the light is, you know, totally liberated, but compared to the degree of condensation which exists when I'm looking at my tape recorder, my glasses, my computer, whatever, all of this is frozen light, says the Kabbalah. But in Shambhala, you live in an atmosphere that is called by a very interesting name on the logoic plane. It's called the Sea of Fire. You know that. The logoic plane is called the Sea of Fire. And in that logoic plane is a condition, at least for our cosmic physical plane, which is considered unfettered enlightenment or unfettered light. Unfettered enlightenment means knowing everything there is to know about the entire planetary sphere. When we have fettered enlightenment, we know some things and we don't know others. We're in a state of ignorance. Fettered enlightenment means chained enlightenment. You're in a state of ignorance. You may know something, but other things are outside your ring pass not. Within Shambhala, everything is known about the entire planetary sphere. Now, the blazing light of the monad participates in those high states of awareness. The monad is a knower of many things planetary and has a type of omniscience relative to the planet. And light, of course, is equivalent to fire and motion. Vibration, light, fire, motion, they are all, in a way, equivalent ideas. So here is this fantastic blazing light, just like the light of the sun, and it carries its own heat. And now it has a means of reaching us via the bridge of light that we have built. And as it touches our structures, it burns up everything that is not like itself. Now, there is a wonderful statement on page 82 of the Rays and the Initiations, I think. Well, it should be on 82. Fire is the sum total of that which destroys form, produces complete purity in that which is not itself, generates the warmth which lies behind all growth and is vitality itself. This is one of the excellent definitions of fire at the bottom of page 82 in the Rays and the Initiations. And when I said that the monad destroys all that which is not like itself, that it doesn't happen immediately, the monad is the archetype of what we are supposed to be on all the different levels of our being. The monad holds our divine name and our divine geometry and our divine sound, and we, as Plato would tell us, have to model ourselves after the great forms or the great archetypes. He didn't call it on higher planes, but, you know, he was an initiate and he knew that that's where it went. So how do we know how we're supposed to be in the world? And the way we're supposed to be is how we are on the higher planes. Now, we're a long way from being that, but you can be sure that if a master makes a Maya Virupa through Kriya Shakti, that Maya Virupa is going to be a lot more like he really is than we are like we really are. In other words, we are far departed from our true inner name. We are not like yet our true inner name, but the master is. And suppose Sanat Kumara decides to create a vehicle, which I think, you know, maybe he has one, and he puts that vehicle forth on the systemic ethers. That vehicle is going to be a very, very close representation of what this great being actually is on a high level. So that's what the blazing light of the monad does. It burns up that which is not like itself, and that's what we call purification. See, purification is a second-ray method, destruction a first-ray method, organization a third-ray method. Those are the three qualities that come from Shambhala. Purification, destruction, organization, ray 2, 1, and 3. And what purification does is it restores form to its archetypal model. If the form is too bad and hopeless, it has to be destroyed. Purification, you say, okay, the form is good enough, we can purify it, and we can make it reflect the archetype. But if the form is too deviant and too resistant and too hard when compared with the archetypal model, then you need the first ray destruction. So have you had those experiences in your life where sometimes you go through purification and sometimes you go through destruction? Have you ever been in something that just had to be destroyed? Because it would be against the law of economy to try to purify it. It would be just too much effort. It's just too different. It couldn't be that way. Like DK said an interesting thing, he said, it would have been hopeless for humanity to return to the conditions which existed before the First Great War. He said they were so confining, so locking, so anti-distributive, that it would have been extremely dangerous for humanity to return to those forms. They had to be destroyed. And you know what happened after the Second World War? People said, oh, let's go and rebuild the old churches just the way they were. And the old buildings and the old this and the old that, go back to just the way they were. Well, that, you know, what's the point? Because the destruction came in so you could get the life moving. Yeah. Okay, so in Coventry they left the ruins and then they built it. Okay, that's very smart. As a reminder of what had really happened. So what happens to us when we respond to the blazing light of the monad? That's the point. When we're on this burning ground, the distractions in our life are swept away and the essentials are restored. And DK says, always go for the essentials. Well, what is the essence? What is the quintessence, the essential? It is that which reflects a higher archetype. It's a pattern that does that. Now, here he gets quite specific about it, wording it otherwise. When the will aspect streams from the monad and focuses through the personal will, as far as the mind can grasp this, it destroys all elements of self-will through the fire. Okay, so Christ had the archetypal experience about the difference between self-will, which for him was soul will, and the will of the Father, right? So he's in the Garden of Gethsemane. He is taking the sixth initiation, or on the verge of doing it. He has a plan, says the Tibetan. He has a plan for the redemption of humanity, because he's the world savior. He's the head of the hierarchy. And this soul plan is not what God wants. God, the planetary logos, wants something else. And in the Garden of Gethsemane, there's this huge internal struggle before the Lord Maitreya acquiesces to the divine will, anchoring the first great strand of divine will on our planet. And then he says, classically, as we all know, and we say to ourselves, not my will, Father, but thine be done. So a huge struggle has occurred between what that great soul thought to do and what the higher wisdom of God the Father sought to see happen. Now, we can use the analogy when we look at our own life. Here's the monad. It may just have a little different idea about what we're supposed to do than we have. We, an intelligent personality, have an idea. We have a plan. It could be self-will. We can even call it soul will. And then the monad comes along and destroys by fire this self-will, even this soul will, and we are left with the alternative of doing the monadic will. And I would like to propose that the way this monadic will works is in a very simple mantra. Master Maurya calls it the common weal, W-E-A-L, which means the common welfare. And I would like to propose that this great will works in the following way, according to this mantra, the greatest good of the greatest number. In a large sense, the greatest good of the greatest number, which is very different from what we think we should do. It's looking at the big, big picture. And so we finally say to ourselves, okay, The plan is trying to express the greatest good of the greatest number. So I acquiesce, I give in to, I give up my personal will to align it with the greatest good of the greatest number as the plan is indicating the way to achieve this. And the plan represents the purpose. Now, have you had in your own life an experience about two streams of will? Your own fairly enlightened will, let's say? Forget your personal will. I want to do this. It's not about that. Now we're trying to talk about something that is in the spiritual life. You have a plan. Maybe it's a pretty good one, and you're living a pretty good life, and it's spiritually useful, and now a higher indication of still greater good comes into your life. Has this ever happened to you? You know, you have to ponder it, you know. Has it, if it's happened, how has it happened? When has it happened? See, I'm reminded this, you know, and I've told you this before. I've mentioned it often that DK said that those whose purpose is to express their soul will not be able to be used for the great movement called the reappearance of the Christ. At first, to me, this was a huge contradiction. I thought we are supposed to express our own soul. But there's something higher than the content of your causal body being expressed in time and space, even though that's very good. It is, you know, it's the classic story of the rich young man, isn't it? He did everything right, fulfilled the law, everything good, and so Christ says to him, one thing is missing, only one, everything else is good, just sell all you have, give the money to the poor, and follow me. Well, that's all that's missing. Everything else is just fine. So it's that classic difference between soul expression of a third degree initiate and someone who's really willing to get with the divine plan, which is found on the cosmic ethers, the atmic and the buddhic plane. And that is something I think we will all face. And I think when the monadic fire descends, it starts to reveal very simply the big picture. What's most important? Oh, but I want to do this, but wait a second. If I am the group, if I am humanity, if I am the planet, all of which are true in the language of identification, then this is the next thing for me, for the big me. This is the next thing. What really needs to be done is this, not what you thought would be a nice thing to do, and it would have been just fine, but this is what's needed. So the need of the larger sphere is what is revealed by this monadic will. In other words, God's need, the planetary logos, his plan, what's next for the great being, that's what's revealed. They had to jump to their death. Yeah, somehow in the yoga, Yogananda book, that's where it is. The whole idea, the requirement was just to leap off a cliff, and it was, you know, a great test of faith and so forth. Wasn't it so? And then, of course, he revived him immediately, no problem. But he had to show the whoever this disciple was, I forget, was it Lahiri Mayaseya, or who was it? One of those guys. Is one of the high disciples. He climbed so far to reach, and he reached the top, one of them. And then Babaji said, no. So he jumped off the cliff or something. I forget exactly how it went. But anyway, it was a test. Yeah, this is not normal and useful, but a way of demonstration. Yeah, there are many ways to get home, and it's not that we necessarily will have to jump off the cliff. Well, Denmark doesn't have a whole lot of cliffs anyway, does it? I mean, maybe somewhere. If I was living in England, I'd get worried about it, because these cliffs at Dover, they feature into many dramas, you know, of a Shakespearean kind. Someone's jumping off the cliff, you know. In King Lear, it happens, and in that marvelous movie with Richard Harris, it's called The Field. It's a real King Lear type of story. The cliffs of Dover are there, and, you know, all of the... Yes, the white cliffs of Dover, yes. And Gloucester in King Lear, he's had his eyes gouged out, and he's feeling so depressed. And he wants his son... disguises himself as someone else and finds his father and is leading his father around, and the father just wants to be led to the cliff so he can jump off and end his life. And of course the son doesn't really lead him to the cliff, but leads him just to a place where he can pretend to jump, and then changes his identity again and meets him at the bottom, and then tells him, it was miraculous how you were saved. And then he really begins a new life, having, in a way, committed the act. Now he can live again. So there are many ways that cliffs figure into the esoteric story. Bruce Lyon has a kind of funny idea about the coffee house on the cliff, where you sit there and drink coffee, discussing what it would be like to jump off the cliff instead of actually doing it, you know. So all the different ways, the height, the depth, you know, what would happen, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all about talking your talk instead of actually jumping off the cliff. Well, anyway, the monad is quite a drastic force. And I think it liberates us into a life that is beyond the individual life. We might say, wouldn't it be great if we could focus on our causal body? And it would be great if we could do that, because then all the good that we've ever managed to accumulate would be at our disposal just like that. But that's not enough. Even that has to be sacrificed. And what's it sacrificed to? A higher perspective, which a higher will tries to see enacted. So let's just, you know, he says, how do you learn about the will? Somewhere he says, study history. Study the great movements. Study the great planetary process. All the time, he directs you to the big picture if you want to learn about the will. You know how it is that first-rate people, they don't care much about the details often. You know, they see the big picture. They don't care about a little of this and a little of that. They have their mind very, very wide in the planetary process. Of course, I don't want to give you the wrong idea. Master Moria also says, the smallest grain of sand can stop the largest wheel. So, he's meticulous, he's particular, but his mind is also on the great planetary process. So, in a way, both are involved. As the energy of Shambhala streams out and makes a direct contact with humanity, omitting the transmission via the hierarchy, which has hitherto been customary, you have what is seen in the world today, a destructive conflagration or a world burning ground. And, you know, DK said that the seven men, all Germans, or Austrians, who invoked the war and the Black Lodge, that they really invoked Shambhala. That's what he said. And they invoked Shambhala without the intermediaryship of hierarchy. And they invoked the most destructive aspect of the Shambhalic energy, and not the more, well, it's all divine, but they invoked destruction specifically.
If you are to define the spirit of man, would you say it's equal to the monad period?
The spirit of man?
The spirit of man.
Okay, I just want to make sure I heard you. Did you say spiritual or the spirit of man? The monad is the one spirit. So no matter what type of spirit we're talking about, it is the one monad. It is, for the individual, his spirit aspect. It is, for humanity, the spirit aspect of all humanity. It is, for the planet, the same. The interest... DK complains about the words that he has to use. He doesn't like isolated unity, but he uses it. He doesn't like identification, but he uses it. And he doesn't like the word monad, but he uses it. So the thing about the word monad is it means one. And there's no such thing as my monad and your monad, just the way there is no my soul and thy soul. There's only the one spirit of the universe which has diversified in the movement from the one to the many, but the many have never left the one. So even though it seems like we all have a spirit center, when you retract the spirit that you are back to its source, it just is the one thing. So when we talk about the spirit of man, what it means is that there is a strand of the one being that is an emanation from the one being, which is immersed in a field of matter of a certain density and a certain scope, and that field of matter we call humanity. That spirit is immersed in that particular atmosphere or dimension, which we call humanity. It's still the same spirit as the spirit in anything, but it seems to be separated by the confines of the field in which it is immersed. I'll give you an idea from a familiar diagram, which is called Parabrahm, and you've seen it many times on page 1230, there it is. You get the implication of it. All of these separate little circles are really one circle. And even this is not the top of the whole pie, you know. This is not the top of the pyramid. Yes. Okay, can you compare it with the sea, the dewdrop, the drops? In a way, you could, because out of the great atmosphere come many, many drops, but then evaporation makes them all, in a way, return to their source. There's another analogy about the dewdrop and the shining sea, that every little dewdrop is the shining sea and slips into the shining sea. So in this great story about the life of Buddha, there was a theosophist poet, his name was Arnold. What was his first name? Edmund, something like that. So he ends this marvelous poem, 100 pages poem about the life of the Buddha. He calls it Light of the East, something like that. And in the end of the poem, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea. So the dewdrop is not different from the shining sea. It has a temporary, apparent distinction. And that's all any of us are. We are temporary, apparent, distinct units, which are all of us, nothing but the one thing that we have come from. And this, somehow this diagram about Parabrahm, it begins to show you how this distinction is unreal. You know, you can say, well, where was I in the last universe? Well, what I do you mean? There's only one I you ever could have been in the last universe, and that is a ray of the one being. No different. Not individual. You were the last universe. You weren't in it. You were it. And thus it has ever been. And that last universe has been the infinitive emanation of the only thing that is. So you've never not been present. You've always been, God is. And if I think I'm different from you right now, for practical purposes I am, but essentially I'm not. And that is what we have to recover, the realization that separation is an illusion. And it takes a lot of work to do that. But every once in a while, you know, something happens and you realize that it is the case. Well, it's almost time for a break. Did you have a question, Anne? No. Maybe you were just indicating to me. By the way, I have to finish this sentence. So, you have a world burning ground. When the antikarana of the group is rightly constructed, then the individualized group will disappear. Even, you know, we're working towards group will. But that's not enough. The individualized group will, which is limited, even though it might be well-oriented, will disappear in the full consciousness of monadic purpose or directed will. See, it all comes down to this particular sentence, who do you think you are? You know how we say to somebody, who do you think you are? You know. Well, that's a good answer. Yeah, tell that to the right person. Okay. Who do you think you are? So, I am the group. Well, yeah, that's more true than I am the individual, but I am the group is a limitation too, isn't it? Who am I? There's larger ring pass knots all the time. I suppose I should say rings pass knot. Okay, more proper. There's larger and larger rings pass knot. And we have to keep on shifting our identification every time we want to get a dose of the higher will. Because the higher will is always coming from a larger ring pass knot. Now, right now, you know, here I am. Disciple, aspirant, whatever, what's the divine will for me? Well, maybe I begin to identify as a group. Well, what's the divine will for the group? Well, maybe I begin to identify as humanity. Well, what's the divine will for humanity? Well, maybe I begin to identify as the planet or the solar logos, and on it goes. Now, it doesn't get practical if you go too far, because even the masters and some of the highest beings, they don't know what is the divine will for the solar logos. Or for the local cosmic logos, or the one about whom not me said, they don't know that. And it's not practical. It's only practical to know that there is always an ever higher demonstration of the will. That's practical. So anyway, even the group will is not enough. The individualized group will. In other words, break the group causal body and get the group connected with the monad. That's what he's saying here. So the group will disappear in the full consciousness of the monadic purpose or clear directed will. These are points which the disciple preparing for initiation, and all disciples do prepare for initiation, which the disciple preparing for initiation has to consider as he prepares for the higher initiations. And these are the points which any group or ashram in preparation for initiation, let's call it the third eventually, has also to consider. So these are big issues about what we really mean by the will and what, to what extent personal will is getting in the way of our higher will, to what extent soul will is getting in the way of our higher will. One day, nothing's going to get in the way when the fire has done its work and the burning ground has successfully removed all the obstacles. Okay, now you can have coffee. Okay. All right. We'll come back in 15 minutes, everybody. By 11:15 here, which is 9:15 GMT. Whoa. There's so many things to step over, aren't there? It's really an obstacle course.